Off the Ball, GAA.
You would have associated Cork with small, nippy players. That seems to be changing now. They're big, nippy players.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
Ireland's sports breakfast show.
Yeah, you just have to be there.
You know, yeah, to be there.
It was just great to say, like, Ireland was there for that. You know what I mean?
You have to be there.
I wish I wasn't there.
You have to be there.
Right, this week's You Had to Be There is very special. Former colleague of ours, long-standing friend of the show, Dermot Ling, how are you?
I am good, Gerry, yeah. Pretty good.
What's going on?
Jeannie, plenty. Plenty going on, Ger. I'm trying to master a world that I don't know anything about at the moment, like social media and crowdfunding and how to disseminate information. And then also deal with people who have a lot more money than I have, because we're trying to build an Irish language and retreat centre in South Kilkenny.
South Kilkenny. This.
I'm in Ballyhale.
Right.
I'm in Ballyhale.
Whoa.
Yeah.
The lure of the hurling there. There's obviously a wellspring that called you back.
Well, you know, it's funny. My mother's from Thomastown.
All right. And, like, that's where the hurling comes from.
That's where that's been suggested, much to the chagrin of my father, I must say. And he still comes up and he's like, "How do you?" How do you live here amongst them? You know, he really still lays it in. But no, we're there, and we, like, in fairness, I just thought Wexford was like, I was Wexford and Wexford was me. Like, there's no separation, and there never would be, you know. And I think when I went away, probably when I was a little bit younger, that shifted. And I remember when I was down in Kerry in particular, and I was going through whatever I was going through down there, and I was reading a book, and it was, it might have been Brian Cox, but some scientist anyway, and he was saying in nature, he was talking about home, and he was saying home is the ideal set of conditions within which to thrive and survive. And that was a big departure from my head that had decided this is home. And so at the time I was looking for the ideal set of conditions to just get my head back above the parapet a bit, you know. And so that was, yeah, down in West Kerry, I suppose that was some of the gold.
That was Dingle direction.
Yeah, when I was out in Kountraw, and we did 7 or 8 years out there. But it was more the initial piece of now in Ireland. I'm not worried about it. I mean, Jesus, Ballyhale is as hard for the young fella in me to accept as anywhere. Kilkenny is bad enough, but Ballyhale is, we're going the next level again. Like, there's fellas could be waiting at my gate after a match on a Sunday, on the Monday morning, to have a chat about the game. Like, Siobhan will barely walk up the road with me anymore, because people just want to stop and chat about hurling. And I love it. It's great. I've totally and utterly, like, I love that part of my life, and totally and utterly celebrate it as well. Like, what a great experience it was. But Ballyhale is a different kettle of fish than West Kerry, and we've really just taken to it. It's been
right.
Lovely.
How long are you there?
And again, we're there, well, we went to Callan. There's a Steiner School in Callan, and that's what we kind of were guided by, that lovely community of people there, and they kind of brought us in, and we've been there for 2 years. We've been there for about a year and a half, and we were kind of jumping around for about 6 months trying to figure out where are the ideal set of conditions to thrive and survive for the family. And this is what we found. And then through a friend in the school, she was like, "Oh, there's this little old farmhouse down here, and maybe you'd be interested, maybe you wouldn't." And we said, "Okay, we'll go down and have a look." And we did. And what has been burning in both myself and Siobhan for a long time is there's the Irish language retreats that we run, and we generally have to go off to Clare or to Kerry or to Cape Clear or wherever we run them. But like, the idea that you would have a retreat, a place of retreat in our home, and that's what this is. There's a beautiful long shed, there's a barn for gigs and stuff like that, and there's a back meadow, there's a river at the back to look after. It's like the absolute, it's the dream for us, you know. And so prices being where they are, I mean, I've saved a few pounds, and I've got enough to get a certain amount, and then we've to launch a crowdfund this week to try and get a little bit more, and just bring it all together and get what the lads are asking for it. And so that's the plan.
All right. So it'll be an Irish language retreat in Ballyhale.
An Irish language retreat centre, but also, like, I suppose kind of a place where people can gather, first and foremost. We did a deer tanning retreat there 2 weeks ago. There's a dry stone walling retreat, basket weaving, just things that people are kind of coming back. People are surprisingly you know, you mightn't have said 10 years ago so, but it is the way at the moment. There's a lot of people, one, interested in the language. There's a huge rise in interest in the language. And two, some of, I think, just our usefulness with our hands. I'm part of the educated generation who, like, came out after my teaching and my degrees and everything else. And I was like, well, what can I actually do? Like, what can I build? What can I make? You know, and it's been a lovely journey of discovery that has. And so, yeah, generally when you find something good, you just want to share it.
Yeah,
that's
fair enough.
Kind of how it works, isn't it?
And sorry, Colin, I'll let you come in now. With the crowdfunding, is that live now? Or
that's going to be live on Friday. So we are just, yeah, there's steps to follow. That's what I said, I'm trying to figure that world out and there's steps to follow.
And if anybody wants more information on your social or...
Yeah, Diarmaid Ling, just get in touch. Diarmaid Ling on Instagram or diarmaidling.ie. We'll have the link live on Friday for anybody who wants to. And I'm trying to find, you know, it's such a... Sometimes there's this attitude, like, and I feel it in me as well, you know, it's the old school part of me. And it's a little bit like, oh, you're begging for the money from the people. And it's like, well, we collected... I don't know, it could be 50 or 60 grand worth of different products, different offerings that people have. And so you can go on the fundraiser, they have the mechanism for that. You go on the fundraiser and you can buy an advertisement for Off the Ball with a reputable Dublin film company for 10,000.
Right.
So you get something,
yeah.
I get something, and everybody wins. That's what I'm trying to find, is how do we create a relationship where we're all
right.
winning. That's
yeah.
the plan.
Very interested in the relationship that Ireland has with its own language, actually. So does the retreat entail the speaking of Irish constantly, or is it more about the learning of the language?
Yeah, in some respects, it's like, you know, if I'm, we say, like when I started, for example, like, and we were going out, we might forage seaweed on the shore in West Kerry. Like, you're looking, whatever's in the area, that's kind of what you're doing. It's not, I have a box here, I'm going to take out this box and this is the next lesson, and then we're going to take out the next box and we're going to learn the Mokanilik or whatever. Mm. It's what's out. We'd spend 10, 12 hours outside, and in that time you might be playing hurling, and some people are playing hurling for the first time, and all you're doing then is teaching the language of hurling through movement in Irish. And so it goes into the body very, very quickly when it's something that's, like, if I'm sitting here with you and I start telling you grammatical lessons, you'll pick up a certain amount.
Yeah.
But not so much, I guarantee you. Whereas if you're out and you're just in it and living it and doing it, you'll pick up an awful lot more, you know?
I always thought that's how it should have been taught in school, if they could. Because, you know, like,
for
when
sure,
I hear the word comprehension,
sure.
I get shivers down the spine. Because it was
sure.
like, I did Irish and French, but the other option in my school was German.
Yeah.
As a foreign language.
Yeah.
But it was the most unattractive way to learn it. I understand it because it's general education.
Yeah.
So you have to, I get that. Like, there's always going to be shortcomings when you have that model. But it was such an unattractive way to learn something because it was a comprehension and then answer questions about that comprehension.
Mm.
And you feel like the way if you were sitting here and grammatically correcting me, the natural instinct within is to think that you're back in school. Whereas this is you're trying to make it a natural and enjoyable environment and you pick up stuff.
For sure.
Better.
And it's da hangak. It's bilingual. It's not like, you know, I'm not standing there with a cane, like, saying, you know, you have to speak it. It's like, no, here's the word for that. Like, try and let that come in. Like, that becomes, you're passing over some dillisk. It's like, that's the Irish for it, dillisk. Like, that's what you use.
But Asperl is no problem if someone retreats.
Nah, like, for sure. You have to get through. Like, even sure, we were seeing it with the Irish language speakers down in down in the Gaeltacht. If you go up to Connemara Gaeltacht, like, they'll say Hurlal. There'll be the anglicisation or just throwing English words into the middle of sentences is perfectly fine for a native speaker.
Yeah.
Whereas I found then, if I was like, oh no, I have to, like, that's what exactly as you're talking about, the school, I have to get this full sentence right. It's like, no, if you just don't know what the Irish for cup is, then you just say cup. But get whatever you know. Like, that's the significant shift right there. Is when I was trying to learn Irish, it was like, oh, there's the Irish is out there and I have to get it in here.
Mm.
And when I went down there, I discovered, oh no, there's a load of it in here. I have to learn how to let that out. And once I made that change, the shame, the tension, the fear, the, oh Jesus, you know, that stuff left.
Okay.
And I had that in a big way up to 23. I was really poor at Irish. But once once that splunk was lost, once that kind of got lit up, there's been no going back. You
it's
know?
A brilliant endeavour because, like, I'd say along with Wales, like, one of the few countries don't really speak our own language very well.
Yeah, I think possibly the only one in Europe.
It's mad. You go to any other country in Europe, they'll speak.
Yeah, and what's great at the moment is we're starting to realise it. We're starting to,
why do you think that's changed?
I think we're one of the things we're beginning to understand is the effects of trauma and how to get past the effects of trauma. I think that's a good thing because everybody, like the first thing anybody ever says about their Irish language experience is the trauma from school. And so now we realise that's something that exists. It doesn't something you need to be owned by for the rest of your life. You can just say, okay, well, that's a trauma and I can reintegrate or kind of sort that out for myself and move past it and engage in whatever I want to free of the trauma. So that's one thing. I do think this is probably at a deeper level, but I see it in a lot of people who are coming to us. Like, the English language is a very, very functional language in terms of there's a profound beauty to it as well, for sure. But there's this very, it's a great language to organise, to like run the machine, because that's, I mean, it was very, that's what it was used for as it was spread around the world. It was used to run the machine very effectively, you know. And that, we now know from neuroplasticity that affects, that has an effect on the physicality of the brain, and that can re-engineer itself as you form new thoughts. You can rewire your brain, that's a thing. And then the Irish language is like a way of thinking differently, and coded in the language is a deep appreciation of nature. There's a deep appreciation that we're not, as we get swept up sometimes, and I would have said it to you, like, I'm depressed, or I'm happy, or whatever I am. I've all of a sudden defined my entire being for one moment. But in Irish, they wouldn't say that. They'd say, it's on me, you know, it's on me for a short time. And I might walk off and fall into something else in a while, but for the moment, it's just there. And so there was this kind of, now Manacon McGann has written extensively about this and made it and popularized the idea, but this is what we've been seeing on the retreats, is that there are people who are looking to just re-engage with themselves, particularly with nature a little bit as well, and then with other people and connect with them in a different way. And so that's where we've gotten the most, I'd say, the most deep-seated results of people. Like, you can't teach the language in a weekend. You're not going to learn the language, but what you can do is foster a love for it. And once you foster a love for it, then you're a lifelong learner. And that was my experience. It 3 days. I had 3 days in the West Kerry Gaeltacht when I was 22.
Sorry, I was going to ask you what happened. Yeah.
That was it, Ger. I went down.
Why did you go down?
To go down because I was doing the primary school teaching.
Right. Mm.
And I was, I did a week after I made my debut against Cork in 2004 in Croke Park, Mark and Sean O'Galbean coming on at about 12 points down and giving away about 4 stone to Sean O'Galbean, pure muscle. I was a slight little fella and I came on and I got a guard escort from the Croke Park out to the airport, and I was in Donegal that night at 11 o'clock drinking poutine with a fella who was delighted to see the fella who he had been watching on the TV that day, you know. And then we had to climb Mount Errigal the following morning. It was hell. But anyway, I digress. I did my week there, and then I went down the following Easter. I had to do my time, and it was you might know him actually. Shamie O'Neill was a teacher in Freble where I was training to be a teacher, and he said, "Look, you're not going to get out of here unless you improve your Irish. Like, you're not. It's not going to cut it." I was at the bottom of the class, like by a good portion. They were well able to articulate themselves in Irish, almost everybody else. So I went down, and the rhythm of the Gaeltacht down there sometimes can be a bit of a holiday, a bit of a drinking exercise, and I had just made the Wexford hurling team, and I was like as green as the grass, and so I was told no drinking down there and go training, and so when I went down there I wasn't drinking and I was training. So
right,
you stuck
to it.
Yeah, I was out of the rhythm. Pretty sure I did anyway, but I must have, to the extent that they were doing what they were doing, and myself and a couple more fellas were outside of that group. And then we had this like revolutionary idea of like, let's speak some Irish when we're down here. And so we did 3 days of just trying to speak Irish. And on the third day, I remember going into school the following morning after, it was a Sunday, it would have been the third day. And on the Monday morning, we were back in lectures. And whatever, I had a dream that on the Sunday night in Irish, all in Irish, the dream, I don't know what way, the shape of it was, but it was a dream in Irish. That was what I remembered. And the following morning, it had gone on that transition from, oh, I don't know this thing out here, to, oh, I've got loads of this in here. And the tension was gone, the shame was gone, the Mochanilic was still a mystery, but I'd unleashed something, you know. So that was, once I saw, well, if I can do it in 3 days and I'm coming from a low standard, I feel that if we can create the conditions where other people can possibly go on that same journey as well. Like, so That's been the main aim. And then when I met Siobhan, I mean, she brought in whole other aspects of life that I, like, you know, she's a performance poet, artist. She was bringing in ritual, and her knowledge of nature was of, like, you know, edible plants, the medicines of nature, all of that stuff. I had no idea. When I saw a ditch, I saw a ditch.
Yeah.
Or she saw a medicine cabinet, and she knew all the different things and how you use them, you know. So I was enthralled by that. I thought that was great, you know. And I felt as well, you know, it's a big thing at the moment, generational trauma, they talk about it. I remember one day coming out the back of Enniskillen, and I was picking whatever, it might have been, I don't know, nettles or whatever the hell I was picking, but it was in the ditch anyway, picking something, and a car came. And my immediate reaction, before I even realised I was doing it, was I stood up and I pretended to be walking. And I don't, like, okay, maybe there's a social or a socioeconomic reason for that in the present, but I also felt there was something of a past trauma there of, like, I don't want to be seen to be the poor Irishman eating out of the ditch, because that's what we underwent, you know, a few generations back, you know. So it's really, lovely. They're all lovely realizations that have come, and then the people that have come into my life as well since that change. I don't think I would otherwise have been in many of the situations they ended up in, you know.
Well, people always talk about it as a joyous thing, meeting like-minded people, but it's also good the opposite, meeting people with other interests that get you involved that way. And you also want something relatable, because, like, my trauma is like stalactites, stalagmites, algebra, Irish oral exam, where, like, a buddy of mine is leaving certs, Irish oral exam, accidentally said he plays for Munster and had to go through the whole thing. And then the instructor was, where'd you play? What position? And your man was, like, sweating, like, absolutely dripping down, like, I was like, this is how. And then all you're doing in that scenario is, like, get me that grade so I can get out of here.
Yeah.
And leave this thing behind.
Yeah. And to reduce such a rich part of us to that is a travesty.
Do you know what I mean when I say it, though? Like, that's,
oh yeah, yeah, sure. I was in it too, man. Yeah, I did the very same. Did the very same stuff.
I know this is supposed to be, you had to be there in a sporting endeavour, but this itself is very interesting.
Yeah,
topic,
you had to be there at the Gaeltacht 12 years ago.
Yeah.
You talk about wildness a lot, right? We've had those conversations before.
Yeah.
Not to make the worst segue of all time, but that's what type of a hurler you were. Not pre-programmed, instinctive, off the cuff, trying to be of the moment of the game. Is that fair? Am I jumping too far here? Or because you weren't a routine hurler?
No. I wasn't, definitely, and it's definitely what I've championed. Like, I mean, I don't spend too much time looking to myself on that. But I do look at Tommy Welch's weight, and we've had that conversation as well. Like, he was my champion of that, like, the antithesis to this mechanised version of sport that's constantly coming in as more and more people kind of get their claws on the ever-expanding operation of the entertainment of sport or whatever that is, you know. I can remember now, definitely, people, you know, managers saying, like, just go out and do what you do, like, you know, bring your enthusiasm or bring whatever it is that you bring, just go out and do that. And that was how... It was definitely a very instinctive, joyful process for the most part. As the more the systems came in, the more I probably, I'm not great with complexity of any kind, you know, and it began to get more complex, and I found something that was actually quite simple was becoming more complex and less enjoyable than it needed to be. So I have railed against that because of that, you know. But yeah, the wildness, yeah, it's not a wildness in chaos or where you break rules or anything like that. There's an abandon that is an energy source, a real physical energy source, and we're looking for, like, minutiae now to, you know, energy drinks or, you know, diet, whatever. Like, everyone's trying to outdo each other for the next little small gain. And when I look at someone like Tommy Welch and maybe to a lesser extent myself, I saw somebody who just had the energy of abandon. They didn't care. Like, I remember asking Tommy one time when we were on a trip, I was like, what are you benching at the moment? It was 5 minutes after he started to answer the question, when he spent the first time, he was laughing. Like, he just thought it was a hilarious question that you'd ask him, you know, as if it was just intolerable to him. Like, you know how he is, like, and it was such a great response, because who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? Like, Tommy, when Tommy hit the ball up the field, you know, like, fucking the whole of Tullerone went with him. Like, he was just... Whoa, like, here's all of me, like, here's all of me. And I say that now. I went back playing Junior B last year, actually. That definitely should be on the list. A great couple of games of hurling last year.
For who?
With the Martins.
Okay, you, so
yeah, there wasn't an intercounty transfer. My brother, Michal was still playing, and hopefully Kieran will play this year. So I went back down and played with them. And that's what I was saying to the lads at half time or before the game, like, you know, just show us who you are. Like, who are you? Just let me, let us see that. And we went out and played this amazing game of hurling where young fellas were just like, just started unleashing this force inside them. And I just think that's, why else play?
Yeah.
Why else, why else play? Yeah. There's reasons, I suppose, to try and master certain things in the game. But I just think, I just want to know who you are on the field. Can you be an extension of who you are on the field as to what's inside of you? Can you let that out as opposed to being up in the head and mechanising the process? That's what I feel about it, you know.
What's your instinct reaction to being described as a wild earner?
Well, with the caveat of like playing off the cuff and that kind of thing, for sure. I in some respects, I would have liked to have been even wilder again in that regard. The wildness has probably come in later. Like I had an experience last week, like at the deer after the deer tanning retreat, and there's a primal wildness, and up to now I have intellectually understood that primal wildness, and I was standing in the back meadow overlooking the river last week, and wow, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, it was just wow, this is really like, what is that? That is really, that's a force, because I'm launching this thing. And I need now to step into a role, you know, for it could be for 5 years, it could be for 10 years, it could be for the rest of my life, it could be for 6 months, I don't know. And for that, there needs to be, I can't do it from my head. There needs to be like an energy force to drive that, to, you know, to magnetize people towards it, to see what I see and feel what I feel, you know, like that's, so I have to really, and that, I just felt that, whoa, that was coming in, and it was coming through me, and it is an addictive element to it, you know. Like, yeah. It's like, whoa, more of that, please, more of that. That's, I can see everything. I can see I'm present to everything here, and it doesn't feel. It was not like in admiration of nature in a soft, poetic, beautiful way. It's like it's a rawness, you know. Yeah. It's lovely. It's really lovely. Really, really, really nice experience. Like, you know.
Yeah, because I was reluctant to describe you as being at one with nature, because that itself is a cliche. But I would say that, would your attitude and general philosophy to life be atypical in the GAA world?
I don't know. I suppose, after the over 40s All Ireland final last year, Lara Corbett said to me, I don't know what you do, but I like it.
That'll be a great epitaph to have.
Yeah. I don't know what you do, but I like it.
Were you playing against Tipperary for Wexford?
Yeah. Oh, they're the over 40s last year.
No, I would have definitely watched that.
Oh, it's like,
who won?
Jared. They had like 12 of the 15 were of like the 2010. They had a ridiculous team, and we had a good setup as well, and we bet everybody else, but the Tipperary were far too good for us. But it was the most enjoyable hurling. An appreciation for each other, a kind of I think it's doable. I see how reckless it might be, but I think it's doable. After the game, we're at a different stage of our lives. Okay, we have to accept that. But after the game, both teams got in for a team photo, in together, like Tipperary, Wexford, mm-hmm. Wexford, Tipperary, whatever. There was fathers or kids in. Yeah. Like, the whole thing was just this. This is what I signed up for. This, like, okay, I can hate you for the 70 minutes and I'm going to want to kill you for the 70 minutes, but I tell you one thing, afterwards, you're me in a different place.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think that can be...
Now that you're living in Kilkenny, you can appreciate that.
Did it those games and that game against Tip, did it start in a kind of friendly, hi, how are you manner, and then 3 minutes into the game, you're back?
Ah, no, we're all competitors. We all knew it was a battle on, like, you know, there's no doubt about that. There is moments in the game where there's definitely a friendliness of the exchange, you know, like some fella might pick you up, and it's all, you know, sort of taking the piss out of each other about just being old or about being bald or about being slower or about, you know, there's just like that general banter back and forth, like, because it's all true. Yeah. But it's only true because, yeah, they were kings one time. Like, you know, Owen Kelly's on the field. Like,
Owen Kelly,
it's the greatest hurler ever. Yeah. Like, you know, and And Larry is moving all over the place and coming in behind fellas and catching it over her head and sticking it in the net. And Paddy O'Brien was playing. I was marking Paddy O'Brien. And when I went into UCD, Paddy O'Brien was king. Paddy O'Brien was like 19 or 20 and he was on the Tipperary and he was tearing it up. And then he got, it's a pubic symphysis, that thing in the groin, you know, and he spent the next, like, I think 5 or 6 years trying to rehabilitate it. And I was marking Paddy and it was a real moment for me. Like, I was like, oh, this is the, because I was way off the pecking order when I was in UCD. And I always kind of wondered, what is that? What is that Paddy O'Brien effect? What are they talking about Paddy O'Brien for? What is he? And I remember in the first half, he went over to the sideline and the ball was kind of diagonally going towards the sideline under the stand in Burris Lee. And Paddy went out to get it. And I could see halfway through that he was already 5 yards ahead of me and I wasn't going to get there. So I could see Corbett was after drifting behind. So I said, right, I'm going to turn and I'm going to cut the pass off to Corbett. Now, everybody else who I've ever played against in my life, I knew exactly what they were going to do. It was going to come back across. Lar was inside me on the goal side. I was more in towards midfield. And the only pass was straight into Corbett. But all my momentum was going that way and Paddy O'Brien could see that because Paddy O'Brien, it turns out, I understood what the fuss was about. He could see, even though I was headed, because I was headed this way, he played the pass across the back of my direction of momentum.
Okay.
And I could see it happening. I could see him doing it. I turned and got my hurl out and the ball just rolled about 1 inch past the top of my hurl. And I was like, ah, oh, that's what it is. That's genius. Like it was a moment of, and I went out to him and said as much. I was just like, oh, I just so delighted I witnessed that. Fair play. What a pass.
What did he say?
Well, I said it to him after I caught the next ball over his head. So he said, pretty good snap, man. And that was his response. And we had a little laugh. And then went back to it, you know. It was nice. It was really nice.
Those stories are cool, though, because, like, you can talk about the goals and the pint and the great play, but that subtle bit of genius you might easily miss in the stands or on TV.
I'm always looking for those moments where something happens that's like a... It's greater than the sum of its parts. I always want to find. I'm always looking for that. When I go to a game, like I spend very little time in the. That's what didn't make me a great pundit. I'd say at times I was always looking for, where is somebody? Where's the magic? I want to see the magic. You know, we're just like the two boxers who just go toe to toe and just go for it. Like that kind of. That I think those when you. That's the problem. I think sometimes with the systems is that they prevent that magic from occurring. Not within the systems, they can still occur, but. When you go toe-to-toe, you find what's in you. You find out what's inside you, you know?
I guess the systems are the bread and butter, isn't it? That's where you get your consistency from if you want to be champions. But we're looking for the magic every day to talk about.
Well, I think the essence of creativity, magic, whatever you want to call it, is structure. Because if you're drawn in from everywhere...
Then it truly is
then
wild.
Then it's the paradox of choice, kind of. There's just too much. So you put a structure in, and from that structure you can go out. But the problem is like the structure has just gone in and in and in, and so like there's not really as much room to look out. I think at the moment, who knows? The game is still, you know, fantastic. So I don't want to, you know, that's and it'll be the old player saying, "Oh, geez, back in my day." It's just sometimes I wonder with the youngsters' games or whatever. I just sometimes these systems coming in is like, come on, let them go at it. Like let's just see, you know.
I hear that reluctance all the time. Lately, particularly for someone, for whatever reason, retired sports people saying, like, I don't want to be the old, it's almost the reluctance to share some wisdom from knowledge gains.
Because you might be labelled something. Because it's so easy to respond. And what we're trying to avoid when we're speaking, I think, all times is we're trying to avoid triggers. Like, if you say a certain word, systems. I mean, you have a different understanding of what systems and what the excesses of a system is versus what I understand it to be. And so I think if when you say something from that place, there's just an easy, that's that thing. So I try and circumvent that so you can kind of bypass and actually get what's worthwhile across. And so it's just you're acknowledging the person's cynicism and then you can move past it. I suppose it's maybe a technique of conversation or whatever.
A specific question. When was the first time you saw somebody score from a sideline? You were one of the first people I ever saw do it. Do you remember?
I do. Yeah. Martin Story scored 2 in the Leinster final in 93.
Oh, right. Okay.
I might have seen it before. Jimmy Houlihan in the league, maybe against Laois up in O'Moore Park in maybe 1988 or 9.
All right. Okay.
6 or 7. I was right by him. I remember just I have memories of those of some of those things.
So that's where your idea, I'm just going to go for this. Like,
No. I don't know. I mean, Adrian Fenlon obviously kind of mastered the art just before I came in. And then, like anything, sure, it's like when you got in front of the microphone, like it's just you do it, you try it, you see what it's like. Oh, no, that works. I know how to do that.
Because now it's become slightly commonplace, but it's still amazing.
Yeah. I used the Randall Hurl as well, and the Randall Hurl was kind of designed, to my mind, like there was a lot of weight in the, there was a lot of hurl, I would say, a lot of ash in the bottom of the hurl. This perfect shape, but he never compromised the balance of the hurl to get that little, so other hurls, to keep them balanced, you might have less ash in the base, whereas Albert would put this lovely thick back on it. And the way that Adrian Fenlon kind of, that I learned from Adrian Fenlon, was you cut, like a golfer, you hit the ball first and then you cut the ground after, and that creates a little bit of a spring, you know.
Yeah.
And so by the end of it, junior, like 80, 70, 80, 90 yard sideline cuts became possible. I used to love it. I used to love it.
Let's do some of these games, right?
It might be time.
Well, how easy was this?
Slightly, like the most difficult part was, I suppose I had, it brought up the trauma of one of our first conversations when I started working for Off the Ball. And when you asked me about going to what stadiums I had been in, and or my favourite stadium, and I said Croke Park, like, it shows a kind of a lack of variation or the ability to have, like, actually have an interest in other sports or whatever it is. So when I went back, it was a lovely experience to go back over the things that, like, why do you have the memories you have? What are they, and why do you have them? And so it was nice to look back on some of those things. But there's a big difference in kind of two or three of them versus the rest of them. And the two or three all go into the top number five. And that is, to me, to my mind, sport is more as entertainment. Like, when I was over in America, I went to ice hockey games and basketball games and ended up in all kinds of funny situations in those places. But it was a big, massive, just moment of entertainment. Whereas I would garner a huge amount more of value out of maybe the under 14, like my father brought me to a Wexford under 14 match when he was a manager on the under 14 team, and I was only maybe 9, and I looked at them and I said, oh wow, these are men, these are like hitting
huge.
Each other hard,
yeah.
This is a different, so I, you know, having that awareness, oh, that's the direction that I'm headed, and terrifying the life and soul out of me at the time, you know. So yeah, there's going back through all those things was very nice, because sport has enriched and dotted my life all along, you know. It's the language I speak. Like,
there's two hurling matches and there's a football match. The football match is Wexford against Tyrone in the 08 All-Ireland semi.
Yeah.
Your brother's playing in this, is he?
Yeah. There could have been another one. There definitely could have been another one there. I think it was the Offaly championship game against Offaly, where Matty Ford scored, I think, maybe 3-7, and just gave probably the greatest exhibition of football that I'd ever seen. And to witness somebody in their mastery is always a lovely thing. But the 08 game between Wexford and Tyrone, I mean, there was a lot. Wexford hurlers were kind of starting to go off a bit of a cliff at that time, and the footballers were really in the ascendancy, and it was quite a difficult time, you know. And I was captain of the hurlers at the time, and I was still going pretty well, and I had this dream of what I would do with Wexford, and none of this didn't seem to be materialising, you know. We weren't going well, and the footballers, on the other hand, with Kieran playing, were really going well. And there was a little bit of, like, bit of envy, I would say, like a bit of an enviousness of a setup and a team that were, like, they were in it together. They were really in it together. That group of fellas that played with the Wexford footballers that time were, you know, Red Barry and Adrian Flynn and Kieran, Matty Ford, Colin Morris. They were all, like, they were tight friends as well as everything else, you know. And I had a question, I suppose, how far that envy would go, and how would that influence my relationship with Kieran. Like, would I have an envy to my brother? Would it be that? Would it be that bad? Would I be that selfish? And you don't know. You don't know until something happens, you know? And so when he got the goal against Tyrone, he picked the ball up on whatever, on the 45, and busted his way through and roofed the goal. And I remember, like, I just, like, it takes me zero effort to go right back into that moment and to look at Croke Park absolutely erupting, and the joy and the pride that washed over me, and I was like, thank God I'm not a bitter old fella, you know, like, because I'm sure people are saddled. Like, imagine, like, I don't know if you, sure, all the different things that you could be in, you could be many things. You don't know what's going to come until you're in these heightened experiences, you know. And that was a real heightened experience, and I just felt, oh, I felt so, so happy, you know. I felt so joyful. It was one of the highest points of that I can remember being in Croke Park. That level of pride in him, that was the different, that was the sweeter taste of it, you know. Like, I'd watched Wexford win All-Irelands, and I'd been out there myself, and had, I think we even won a couple of games out there, but seeing Kieran do that, that was a real high point. You know, one of the highest, I'd say.
An element of relief that the default was euphoria.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Because you're walking down Jones's Road a couple of hours earlier thinking, I don't know how I feel about this.
Yeah. And I never had a hostility towards it. You know, I really, like, Jason Ryan asked me in at one stage into the football panel, and I'd love to have gone in some regards, but I knew I wasn't given at the time, and I knew even when I played football with the Martins, I always got the sense with Kieran, he was like, just don't mess this up now, you know, like, you're not doing it, and you're not making the right choices, and he's like, there's a way to play the game, and he knew it instinctively, you know. So I felt that pressure, but at the time, the footballers were, I would have liked to have what they had, and I didn't know what the limitations of that were until we got to the absolute pinnacle moment where it looked like we might actually beat Tyrone that day. And it was Kieran's goal that kind of dragged that back in. Now, you know, it was all magnificent, but Kieran's goal was a real high point. And it was only at that time I was going to find out the answer to my question.
Yeah.
And thank God of gods that it was just pure love, you know.
Why don't we see too many dual players anymore?
It's a really interesting experience I had with Red Barry when he was playing in 05. We played against Kilkenny. I think Shefflin broke my thumb actually the same day, and I was over on the sideline with my broken thumb, and I wasn't on the sideline. I hadn't ever... I had been on the sideline a couple of years previous for sure when I was starting off, but like, I was playing all the games, and so I wasn't really aware of what was happening. And Red was playing football and he was playing hurling at the same time, and he had played a football game possibly even that morning, or had trained or done something, and then come up to Nolan Park, and he was brought on possibly instead of me. So he was now on the field, and I was hearing a bit of the chatter behind me, and the chatter behind me from the Wexford subs was like, what's he doing?
That's my spot.
What's he doing on the field? He just after coming from a football match. He hasn't been training in 3 weeks or whatever, you know, whatever I'm saying. And the first thought that came into my head, I don't know if I saw it, if I said it, I don't think I did, but certainly the first thought that came into my head was, well, what are you doing at training if...
Yeah,
he's getting brought on ahead of you. Like, you know, it's not a... This is a meritocracy here. Like, you know, if you're good enough, you get put on. Like,
yeah,
like
there's no showing up points.
Yeah. So I'd say it's a little bit like that, you know, All Black stuff of, like, the team culture, and you have to be at every training session, contracts and all that rubbish. Like, sometimes I think there's generational people come along to our game, and they decorate the game in a way that is absolutely necessary for youngsters to believe in a kind of a magical future, which it is, you know, and that's what happens in those. We reach levels of experience beyond what is attainable to us in our everyday lives. At least that was my experience of it, you know. And so I think there was always space for a Red Barry or for any other dual player to... What you need? You need a week off from hurling and football. That's fine. You want to come in and train, whatever. Mm. When the game starts, and I noticed that with the soccer, when Kieran was playing soccer over in England, they were like, you know, you couldn't be in a nightclub 2 days before a game, and you couldn't be in a pub a day before a game or something. Like, that was the rule. But if you could run 100 in 10 flat one Saturday and could run 110 flat the following Saturday, or if you were playing well on a Saturday and you played well the second Saturday, it was nobody's business what you did in between. And so... I kind of had the same attitude to it. If you're good enough, if you're doing it and you're adding to the team and you're adding to the whole thing, bring it on. Bring it on. And if the lads who think by training more but are still worse are going to bitch about it, then we unfortunately have to... We say to a Red Barry, you can't be on our team because this fellow over here is upset. Whereas I would have been much more of the attitude, we'll get rid of him because he's upset about everything.
Mm.
And let's bring Red Barry with us because he's a genius, you know?
the, let's stick with Wexford, the 96 yeah. Leinster final, that Offaly team in the mid-90s obviously is storied. And yeah. this is, again, I think maybe people forget, no back door, so it's do or die. And Wexford have had perpetual heartbreak since the 70s.
God, sir.
So what do you remember about this? You're obviously young enough at this stage, 12 maybe?
Quite impressionable. I mean, 96 we won the All-Ireland, so you'd think the Limerick game would be the great mm. day, you know, but it wasn't. It was the game against Offaly, and it was for that reason. Like, as you said, it was a culmination of events up to that moment. That's definitely why I picked it, you know. Like, I can still see, is it Eamon Morrissey scoring the goal against Wexford in, was it 93, to beat Wexford in the last minute. We were up by 7 points, I think, at half-time. And I don't know, did we get a goal or was it a, might have been even a Martin Story sideline, and my father jumped up in the old stands in Croke Park and the old wooden seats with the kind of curved, lovely curved, they weren't very comfortable, but they certainly looked beautiful. I remember him jumping up, my father's a big man, like, you know, and he jumping up out of that and like just losing it on the up the middle of the two sets of seats, whatever that's called. There's a simple name for it, but I can't think of it. He was up there and he was just ecstatic. And part of I know now as a parent what his ecstasy was. His ecstasy was we were witnessing this like triumph potentially over Kilkenny. And then Morrissey scored the goal at the end or towards the end. Maybe it was DJ when he took the 15 steps to score the goal, whatever it was. I don't know. One of those times anyway. And my father was crying. Like, it broke me hard. He's a young fella. I could see the upset. And so when it came to 96, all of those memories in that last, I've got goosebumps now even thinking about it. Like, there was a period there with about 10 minutes to go where the perennial losers were like, you know, Tom Dempsey might put a ball wide in the past. All of a sudden he was off his left-hand side on the sideline on the 14 and it just sailed over the bar, and it grew more and more. What I understand to be magical in a sense, like for a young fella or for an adult now, there's something in the air now. We're not doing what we always did. We're not making the same mistakes. Well, it's getting better and better and better. And then you think it can't get any better. It got better again. And then it's just wave after wave after wave of joy washing over all of us, you know, and this just collective outpouring after this previous generation of heartbreaks, you know. So the Offaly game, yeah, that was I missed from the, I'd say, 6 minutes to go to four to 2 minutes to go, I'd say, because we were up on the top deck in the Cusick, I think that year, and I was just sprinting down like a skateboarder would down the,
to try and invade the pitch,
get onto the pitch. Yeah, man, for sure. Yeah,
knowing that the win was going to happen. I can't find a full time score here, sorry, I'm just looking through, but Jamie Fitzhenry scores a penalty in the first half.
Yeah,
so that's one of those ones where
you and then went back with the big, you know, the effort mixed with the joy of the grin. I can still see Damien doing it. He scored a penalty. What moments that time? I remember Tom Dempsey just taking off towards the end for sure. Yeah, it was all a blur otherwise, but what a moment! Yeah, what a moment!
You've also picked a hurling match between Tip and Kilkenny. National League Final 2009.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, that one.
Why'd you do this?
Well, we played before it against Offaly in the League Two final. 1B or whatever the equivalent was at that time, and it was a much bigger deal, I think. Like, a lot, I think Offaly had gotten relegated and they just kind of, they went to Central Council of Croke Park and kind of said, well, look, this will be the death of Offaly hurling, and
change the rules.
And they said, okay, we'll restructure. Like, there's a few times there where it just kind of had worked that way, where we just said, okay, there's a bigger gap between, like, much better what they're doing now, in terms of 1A and 1B, and giving those teams a chance. But at that time it was like you were going down into something that you might not, in a county like Wexford, you'd be fearing you mightn't come out of it, you know?
Yeah.
So we played against Offaly, and I was captain because we'd won the championship with the Martins in 2008, and I just felt that it was like written in the stars somewhere that I'd get up on some stand and get some cup, and I just felt this was the day, and it was going to be my only chance probably, because Kilkenny were wiping the floor with everybody at the time, you know. And They'd just beaten, I guess the 08 final was Waterford, wasn't it? They'd just beaten
Waterford, they were perfect.
Where it was just like the perfect game of hurling. And so that didn't look like anything was going to change. And we played against Offaly and we got beaten. I was like standing out there, I remember afterwards, what the heck? Like I was so convinced of that vision, you know, I just really had that. I was so sure of it. And I picked myself up anyway, I went over to the sideline and Kilkenny and Tipperary came out. And at that time, Kilkenny had been just in total ascendancy. They were wiping the floor with everybody. They were putting hurling out of every Wexford person's mind at the time, along with the rest of the country. And then finally somebody responded. Now, the All-Ireland final that year and the All-Ireland final the following year is what people kind of think the time that Tipperary got to grips with Kilkenny. But it was that day. That was the first day. That was the first shot fired across to say, no, we are with you. It was the greatest exhibition of the game of hurling that I've ever seen. I was like the young fella again, looking at the under-14s as a 9-year-old. I was like, oh, us and Offaly aren't in the same realm. We're not even playing the same game as those fellas. They are at a different level. The speed, the intensity, the traditional nature of it too. Like it was Kilkenny and Tipperary going toe-to-toe, just standing toe-to-toe and absolutely, totally and utterly going at it in every corner of the field. And it was magnificent to watch. Terrifying, but magnificent to watch.
There is an argument that Tipperary eventually beating them and stopping the 5 in a row means every time that they play historically now is elevated in retrospect. That, like, because the rivalry is real, eventually, that these games, I think people do talk, because we were actually looking for the game where Tipperary won a league, but they didn't actually win it. They got beaten in extra time. But I think they come away from it going, well, we drew in normal time and we could have beaten them, so we're nearly as good as them.
I'm not sure about I understand what you're saying about the retrospective aspect of it, but it was a defining moment for me on the sideline in the moment of watching them play to see how far ahead the game had gone of where we were at. And it was also an absolute, there was a celebration of that, you know, whatever you call it, the kind of the wild nature of my hurling as well, to see fellas who were playing the game in a very traditional, very stand-up, very manly way, that it was winning, that was working. It was working, you know.
It says on Wikipedia there was only 17,000 at the final, so small attendances at league finals, it's not a new thing. And that was in May. It was the May bank holiday weekend. I don't even know if we had a bank holiday back then.
We do have the score for that. It was 226-417 after extra time to Kilkenny. But like the variety and the quality of those six goals scored, and it was Tipperary who had the large portion of success for most of that game. But it was like the James Woodlock kicked it in. And then John O'Brien had an unbelievable curled finish to the far corner where he could have taken a point easily. It was that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And Tommy Walsh cleared off the line as well at one point.
It was frantic, like it was pantomime stuff. It was just like, well, they were just all on. It's just all on, you know. I really enjoyed it.
We've gone mad over time. So your last one's here, Shrewsbury versus Mansfield at Shrewsbury in 2005.
Yeah.
I would not have had Shrewsbury versus Mansfield on your list of you had to be there.
I know, but it was the first time that I went over to England and watched Ciarán play an adult, like the first team game. And I went with a friend of mine at the time, Conor Doyle, and the two of us sat and we had a little nagging of whiskey a little old school flask of whiskey, and it was a freezing cold winter day and Ciarán was out doing his thing and he played really well. And we were in League Two England, you know, and the characters and the richness of the flavours and the smells, and it was just a real unique experience, you know. And then to see Ciarán playing at that level.
How long was he over?
he did 5 years over there. He started off at Arsenal, and he was offered a fairly basic YTS contract with them, and then he went to Preston and did 3 years with Preston. Looked like I think Craig Brown was managing him, and he looked like he was really going somewhere. And then, Craig Brown was the manager, and this other fella came in, and he cleared out like four of the five Irish fellas.
Right.
And he kept, and he didn't get another look in there. And then he went down a division two, to, I think it was a Gary Peters who played with the Crazy Gang of Wimbledon. He was the manager of Shrewsbury, and they wanted to play football, and they were going to be skillful, and they bought certain players. And then they lost the first 9 games and they said, right, route one is back. And Ciarán came back after that and just, a little bit unlucky, but you know, there's a it's a big big learning curve over there.
And to finish it off, it's a bit of glamour. It's Miami Heat in Miami in 2008.
I expected it to go the other way and start off there, because that was just the pure, as I said, like the entertainment of sport. Myself and Owen Quigley, when we were in Miami in around Halloween in 2008. I think after maybe Red Barry Stag or somebody Stag in Edinburgh, we just went straight to Miami from there. I'm not sure how well in advance it was booked, but anyway, we went and we ended up going to this game. And I was outside, so it was $150 for tickets. I was like, oh, my poor teacher Owen. I'm sure Owen was already after buying two tickets for us. And we were there, and I was sitting beside this lovely woman who was on a date with some fella, and sure, she could hear the carry on of us in her accents, and she wants to know. And then at halftime, she was like, do you want to meet Timbaland? I was like, yeah, I'd love to meet Timbaland. You know who that fella is, like, cool. So she sent him a text and she said, okay, come on down. So we went down and I went over courtside, you know, with this woman holding me by the hand, guiding me over to Timbaland. This big fella stands out, huge man. Like, I was like, Timbaland, I love your music. And your man just looks at me, he's like, I'm not Timbaland. And he stood aside and there's Timbaland. The little fella, Timbaland, who we've all seen on the telly, but he'd heard me saying it. And I was just there, my brother loves your music, man. It's nice to meet you. And I had to go back with my tail between my legs and suffer the ignominy of the whole experience. But it was, the razzmatazz and the entertainment. And I was delighted to see it. But my heart is in the game here, you know.
What a great list, Jeremy. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Thanks very much, Jer.
You have to be there.